And the preface to the story, the preface to the sitting is, you know, what are the demons that are lurking in you as you come here sitting here Halloween night? Milarepa was the one of the great saints, spiritual practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism. And he lived for many years as an ascetic, practicing in the mountains and caves. And there's a story of Milarepa coming back to his cave after being gone for some time during the day and finding five demons in his cave. And so he's a little bit perturbed at first, but he realizes that probably these are local deities that are angry with him because he's never made any offerings to them. He's ignored them and never, you know, done anything for them. And so they're angry. And so he starts singing them songs of praise and offers them food. And two of them go away. And the other three begin advancing on him, gruesome, terrible demons, dripping with blood. And then he takes a really wrathful pose. He's kind of filled with wrath and anger and fiercely kind of growls at them. And two of them now run away. But the fifth one, the last one, is hugely terrifying. And big fangs and long, long fingernails that underneath the fingernails are all the kind of dried up the skin of all the previous victims. And blood is oozing out of its teeth and dry blood caked on its beard. And one eye has been gouged and it's coming to get that Milarepa. So what do you do now? I mean, he's tried these two things. And then he realizes that the demons are just products of his own mind. And that their essential nature is empty. So then he, as the big last demon comes approaching with his big wide open mouth, Milarepa lays himself in the mouth of the demon. At that moment, the demon vanishes. So what are your demons? And what are your strategies with your demons? And are there some demons that just won't go away? In the Japanese tradition, Zen tradition, there's a, not just Zen, but I learn of it through the Zen tradition, there's a ceremony called Segaki, which is the ceremony for feeding the hungry ghosts. And part of the ceremony is to do this following invocation. So as we begin this evening, and we invite your demons to come, this is what's in a Zen ritual around the time of Halloween. This is what they say. We invite all diseased ancestors, the spirits of mountains, rivers, and earth, and all the demons of untamed lands to come and assemble here. Now with compassion and empathy, we offer each of you food. We sincerely hope that each and every one of you will receive our offering, turn it over, and pass it on to all. Sentient beings throughout the realm of vast emptiness, may you and all sentient beings together be fully satisfied. Again, we hope your bodies will be conveyed by these offerings and mantras, so that you may let go of all suffering, attain liberation, be born in heaven, receive joy, and play freely in the pure lands of the ten directions. We invite all the demons of the untamed lands to come and assemble here. So that's what we're doing tonight. And now, may you all invite your demons for the sitting and learn how to be with them. Practicing vipassana the first time in Thailand, I was at a small Insight Meditation Center on the outskirts of Bangkok. It was built kind of on the edges of the rice paddies. And the abbot gave me a little kuti, a little hut on stilts, the edge of the monastery to practice in. I was supposed to stay there day and night, sleep there, practice there. And the thing was that the way that we were on stilts, because it was on kind of like a swamp, and there'd be these long planks, planks laid out across the top of the swampy area, so I could walk and get to my cabin, my whole hut. And right next to my hut was, just a couple of feet away, literally, was a grave. And it was built up out of that kind of swampy area, so it was kind of elevated. And I think two people were buried there, and there was a kind of like, it was this big, kind of maybe 6 foot, maybe 8 foot long slab of cement. And then on either end, there was these like little stupas that came up, these little kind of like pillars. And they had a picture, a photograph of each of the deceased. I think it was a husband and wife. And so I would do all my meditation in the little cabin. And I'd do all my walking meditation on that cement slab, because that was the only hard surface that was any length of, any, you know, I could have just walked on the planks, but they weren't so stable. So I did my walking meditation there. I don't have any ghost stories from there, practicing on these people's gravestones. But at one point during that retreat, I was invited by these, I had to leave my little cabin for a little while, for some days, and stay at a little house across the street from the monastery. It was a dilapidated house, abandoned house, it was a two-story house. And I stayed upstairs with these two others, a monk and a Westerner. And in order to get upstairs, we had to walk through kind of the bottom floor, which is kind of like a basement, actually. So you had to go into the basement and then up the steps from the basement up into this deck area above, and then the rooms upstairs. And one evening, the door down to the basement was open, and this dog came in. And this scrawny little dog, like, I mean, if you've been to Asia, you see like this, how scrawny dogs can be. And the thing was, he was going through his death pangs. I'd never seen an animal go through death pangs before, but that's what it couldn't be anything else. It was just withering there on the floor and awful state. And it wasn't clear what we could do for it. It wasn't so obvious that you take dogs to vets and kind of in that part of the world exactly. And it was pretty dramatic watching it withering away there. And one of the people I was with, standing next to me on the steps, standing on the steps, stairwells, kind of looking down at this dog in the basement floor. And he took a really deep breath. And then he blew. Like that. And the dog got up and walked away. I saw it. And so I didn't comment on it. I was kind of like, what's that? And so I went back to my meditation, because it's all I was doing was meditating. But the next morning, the guy who had done the blowing, next morning we found the dog dead. He just died outside someplace. I don't know what the blowing was about and what happened, but what I saw was the dog, you know, it looked like he was about to die. He just got up peacefully and walked out of the room, out of the basement. But the guy who did the blowing explained to me that the dog had been poisoned by the local farmers who found these dogs are kind of like the pests, I guess, in their fields and their crops. And so they put up poison for the local scrawny dogs, and then they eat the poison and they die. And so its kidneys, which I guess processes the poison, was in awful, awful shape. And so he took his breath and he blew life back into the dog. But in order to blow life into the dog, he said, he had to take on the kidney failure that the dog was going through. And now he was in terrible pain, his kidneys. And in order to cure himself of this, this is what he told me. He said he had to have a meeting with his ally. It's kind of like the vocabulary of Carlos Castaneda. And he invited me to come and join him as part of it. So that evening, I said, okay, we were kind of staying in the same little house together. So I was curious, what is this meeting with the ally? This time I've been on retreat, intensive retreat, for probably 7-8 weeks. And so the three of us sat in this little room. There's no furniture, just in the wooden room, at night in the dark, pretty dark. Maybe there's a candle or something. And this guy who wanted to have the meeting, the ally, brought out the biggest Thai stick of marijuana, kind of Thai stick. You know, the biggest one I've almost ever seen. And we proceeded to kind of pass this thing around, this big, big, fat. And I got so stoned. It's probably the last time in my life I've gotten stoned. And I got so stoned. And my everything was spinning. And I couldn't get up and leave. I had to go to the bathroom at some time to go pee, which meant going down those steps and outside. And I couldn't stand. I had to kind of crawl, maybe like the dog, right? I had to crawl down the steps to go outside. And I felt like the whole world was going to collapse, like everything was going to fall apart because I was so spinning. And the only thing I could rely on was my mindfulness practice. And I just kind of noted one breath, one moment, just very carefully, one thing at a time, one thing at a time. And I got through that part of the evening. And the next morning, the fellow was cured. So that was my, you know, unusual. So that was one story. I don't know if that can be appreciated as a Halloween story, but... Then I was at Wat Swan Mok, which is a famous jungle monastery in Thailand. And I was also given a little cabin, a little hut, kudi, off in the jungle, a little piece of clearing in the jungle. And we were told there were a lot of poisonous snakes in that part. Be careful. And there was a little path that went kind of up to my cabin, my hut. And I was also up in little stilts, little steps going up to my little porch, like 3 or 4 steps. And so that path kind of came along in front of my steps and then curved around, went to the side of the cabin and continued a little bit further, 50 feet or so further into the jungle where there was another cabin. And that further cabin, there was a Singaporean monk who spoke very good English, who had been a monk for many, many years. And he was somewhat famous for having been kind of a hermit and having lived in a cave for 12 years or some very long time, just living kind of as an ascetic, living, practicing alone, living in a cave. And he was considered to be kind of very highly attained monk. So one day I was, I guess, on my porch, and he was walking by to go to his cabin further back. And so I came down a couple of the steps. I think I was on the bottom step. And I was talking to him. He was on the ground. I was on the bottom step. And we were talking about, I don't know what, just a little conversation. And it was time to say goodbye. We said goodbyes to each other. And I turned around. I suppose maybe to walk up the steps. But what I did was I ended up turning around 360 degrees on that step. So it doesn't take that long for me to turn around 360 degrees, right? And when I had turned 360 degrees around and was looking back at the exact spot where he was standing, he was nowhere to be seen, but there was this huge snake. What do you think of that? I don't know what to think of it. I don't have a clue what to think about that. I could try to rationalize it. He just walked away quickly, and coincidentally a snake slithered up right there at that moment. Another day in that monastery, it was dusk, and there was a wide dirt road. I don't know how long it was, but at least 6 foot wide, maybe longer. Maybe I say 6 feet, I don't know. It was wide enough for a car to drive on, dirt road in the jungle. And it was dusk. I was carrying my camera over my shoulder. And so we couldn't see very well. And there was this long branch across the road, kind of spread across the road. And it was just a branch, right? So I stepped on it. And it moved. Mm-hmm. And it was this huge snake. And I jumped. I jumped and spun in the air at the same time. And threw my camera down at it, whatever was there, to kind of have something between me and it, because maybe that's what human beings do when they step on big snakes. And, you know, I wasn't doing it. It was just instinct. When I was in Asia, I encountered, there was a very strong belief in ghosts. And I remember in the monastery in Japan, when I stayed there, the Zen monks gave me advice of what to do if I encountered a ghost. And one of them had encountered a ghost, and he said, and what he had done was he had chanted the Heart Sutra. And chanting the Heart Sutra, then the ghost went away. So if you go to practice in Asia, chances are, unless you go to some very modernized, kind of rationalist kind of place, chances are you'll encounter people, at least, who still very much live in kind of a traditional worldview where ghosts are common spirits, demons are common, shall I say, occurrences, you know, common perceptions that people have. So Milarepa, in the story I told you at the beginning, when the fifth demon was coming to attack him, he realized that the demon was empty of any essential nature and was a product of his own mind, and thereby found how to be free of it. He put himself in the mouth of the demon, fed himself to the demon, and the demon vanished. And very common stories in Thailand is of some monk, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mun, a lot of people, would go off somewhat intentionally to places that would arouse their greatest fear. And they would sit there and meditate through the night. A common place was to sit in cemeteries, because cemeteries are, in Thailand, in Thai culture, much of Asian culture are considered kind of haunted places. I guess in the West too, right? Kind of haunted places. And when I was in Hawaii, if you wanted to rent the cheapest apartments or cheapest houses, you'd rent the places that were next to the cemeteries, because Hawaiians of Asian descent wouldn't want to live there. And anyway, so these Thai monks and I suppose nuns would go off and spend nights in cemeteries. And Ajahn Chah tells a story of, tells stories of sitting there in the cemetery and being petrified by something that was visiting him. He'd be sitting there in the cemetery, and maybe late in the evening or the afternoon, the villagers would come to burn a body. Someone had died, a child had died, or some adult had died, and they'd have the cremation. And the smoldering body would be left there. And he'd be left there kind of, 100 feet away or something, with his smoldering body. And they kind of had charnel grounds back then. You know, so they kind of just sometimes they wouldn't bury people right away or at all, just leave in traditional Thailand and leave the bodies there. So going to a cemetery wasn't just simply sitting on a gravestone, but was sitting there with these kind of bodies, bones and stuff around. And he talks about sitting there, meditating, his eyes closed, and middle of the night hearing the leaves on the ground crunching. And something coming closer to him and closer to him. Closer to him, and convinced that this was it. There was like a demon or a ghost or something. And convinced that he was going to die. There was no hope for him. And he said, well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die in the Dharma. And I'm going to die, you know, practicing. Because if you die practicing, that's the best possible way you could possibly die. I'm going to die sooner or later anyway. And if I'm going to die, I'll die practicing. So he practiced. And he was filled with fear and petrified, and it broke out in sweat. And he was thinking closer, closer, closer. Until he felt it standing right there in front of him, right there. This is it. And then it went away. But before it went away, he practiced so intensely, following his breath, being attentive to his breath. He got so concentrated that at some point he broke through his fear and attained a deep state of peace and calm. He was going to sit through his fear, face his fear. So you get a lot of these kind of stories in Thailand. Ajahn Mun in the old days would go into the jungle and sit with places where they still had tigers back then, the wild elephants and big snakes and whatever. The monks would go off into the jungles. And you'd think maybe the stories are often very dramatic. You know, they'd encounter a tiger, or a tiger kind of walking down the path, and they'd be sitting there meditating, and the tiger would walk right by or sniff them and walk away. And I've been told that it was very rare for a monk to ever get killed. But they had these encounters, and they would test their concentration, test their equanimity, test their inner strength, go to places of fear. I guess for us, we would go to the inner city, perhaps. Where would we go if we wanted to go places, sit with our greatest fear? Some people, the place of greatest fear is encountered on retreats, in meditation. And it's really an amazing thing to go sit and meditate in a place that's very safe. Everyone's kind, or at least they leave you alone because no one's talking. People are feeding you and taking care of you. And you know, some of the retreat centers are beautiful retreat centers, state-of-the-art retreat centers. And everything is fine in the universe. And then people get terrified. And they're not terrified by the tigers or the ghosts, but they're terrified by their own minds, what's going on inside of them, by their own demons. And it's really amazing to discover the demons that are inside of us, inside of people, and how difficult it is to grapple with, how difficult it is to sit still and open up and be mindful and be present for some of these deep, dark things that we'd rather not face. And the way kind of seemingly the self, the human, this is constructed, is where we kind of get a sense of self or sense of security in life, is often constructed around a lot of arbitrary, artificial, unhealthy attitudes about who we are and what our needs are and who other people are. And as we sit on retreat meditating, sometimes it becomes necessary to let go of those. Often the whole process of meditation of retreats can be understood as a process of letting go, of all the extra clinging, all the extra efforting we're making from simply being present in a very, in the simplest possible way, just in a sense of pure being, not adding anything to our sense of being. And so as this process of letting go is going on, some of the things we're called upon to let go or to face in the process of letting go, we don't want to let go of, because it seems like to let go of those is we're going to die. We're not going to exist. Who are we going to be? Who would recognize us? We're not even going to recognize ourselves if we let go of this. And people have come to me when I've taught retreats. They've come searched me out, panting, terrified, pale, in panic attacks because nothing's happening except, and they don't have a tendency to panic attacks outside. It isn't like a habit they have, or, you know, a tendency. But there's this, you know, facing some really deep fears inside. Demons. So Halloween, I'm sure you all know, the word hollow is, an old English word, meaning it means sacred. Hallowed ground is a sacred ground. And so Halloween means the evening, the sacred evening. What it means is the evening before All Saints' Day. November 1st is All Saints' Day, which is a very sacred day. And this is the evening before. And there's this polarity, this duality, that becomes quite strong, at least traditionally, I suppose, when all this was made up, between this very sacred day of November 1st, which we've now mostly forgotten about. Maybe Catholics do it still a little bit. Is anybody Catholic here? Yeah? All Saints' Day, is that like a day that you do? It's a holy day that has significance still for Catholics?
I'm not sure about today. Maybe 5 years ago, I'm a little bit more sure. But I think it's still,
you know. And then the night before then is the night for the opposite of that, of the polarity, of the duality, of the demons and the ghosts and the dark forces. And what's happened, as we know, is that Halloween has been commercialized and has become tamed. And we have all these, you know, you could drive over here, you saw all these little cute little angels and demons and devils and witches kind of, you know, roaming around the neighborhood. All very cute, for the most part. It's all been tamed. And you know, angels in the Old Testament were ferocious beings. You didn't want to have an encounter with an angel. And then you have devils and demons and ghosts and all these different forces. And I think it's necessary to be a little bit careful of domesticating these powerful forces of anger and fear and aggression that might be within us, or to pretty it over, or to deny that it's there. See, all cultures, this is my theory, my understanding is that all cultures, including Buddhist cultures, family cultures, social cultures, religious cultures, there's kind of culture. When people get together, they tend to act in certain ways. Probably with some friends you talk with, some friends you talk certain ways with. And other friends you talk different way with. There's a kind of little culture of two people, depending who you're with. And sometimes it can be a little bit odd to have, you know, bring together friends from different parts of your life for whom you kind of relate to in different ways. And suddenly how do you relate now? Because how do you be now? Because you tend to be a little bit different from different people. If you speak different languages, it can be really something to feel who you are, in different language. You know, I'm different speaking Italian than I am in English. I'm different speaking Norwegian than I am in English. I'm different speaking Japanese than I am in English. It's kind of like a different, you know, who am I? Which one's the real Gil? You get the English one. And so we're different people. But so there's little cultures that get created. Big cultures, small cultures. And cultures tend to have things that they desired behavior. Kind of certain kind of ways of being that are considered optimal or the right or appropriate ways of being. And so like Buddhist culture, Buddhism puts a big emphasis on being kind and generous. And so that's part of the culture. You know, you come here and people kind of think that they're supposed to be kind and generous and wise. And, you know, and so they kind of tend to be kind of, some people I know put on their best behavior when they come to a meditation center. Or when they come to see a meditation teacher, you know, I get, you know, they show, they, often I get, you know, sometimes they're the best around me. And then later, they have an interview, and they tell me what's really going on. But but we kind of show certain sides of ourselves. And in showing certain sides of ourselves, we then kind of hide a little bit the sides that we, not so good. So Buddhists tend to come into a Buddhist culture, and they tend not to show their anger very much because, after all, anger is kind of a defilement. You're not supposed to you're supposed to become free of. You're supposed to be kind. So you don't, to easily express your anger in a Buddhist culture, usually, whereas you might in some other. I don't know where, you do that, but I noticed that bar culture in America and Japan is very different. In American bars, people get drunk. I haven't been in a bar in America for 30 years or something, but I've noticed that people get tend to get, as generalization, there's a kind of angry feeling. In Japan, the tendency there is for people to become very childish when they're drunk. So I don't know why different people in different cultures, have different ways of being when they're angry. But maybe bars are kind of safe place to be angry. I don't know. There's probably places where it comes out more. But Buddhist centers, they tend not to come out so much. So it becomes what's sometimes called the shadow, what's hidden. So all cultures have the shadow, that which is kind of pushed aside or denied or not, people are not willing to look at or express. And it's the function of practice, of spiritual practice or Buddhist practice, to reveal the shadow, to show it. And it's healthy. You can't have some kind of culture. But I believe the culture becomes a lot healthier when people are practicing and finding, and through practice, allowing what's deep, dark, hidden, denied, not accepted, to come bubbling up and to be shown and to learn how in some wise way to hold it, at least in the meditation time, with some acceptance, with some wisdom, with some clarity, with some allowing it to be there and to express itself, to really see it clearly for what it is. And I think it's very, very important that we have a place in our life where we allow these things to surface. People are afraid of their depression, and so they're always running away from being depressed. And maybe meditation is not the place to feel joy and calm for some people, but rather to look at the demon of depression honestly, directly, or anger or fear, aggression, fantasies, lust, whatever it might be that we'd rather not have to deal with and look at. So, and part of the advantage of doing it in a spiritual context, maybe in a culture of other people who are practicing, meditation centers or spiritual teachers or whatever, is that it's sometimes a lot safer to allow these forces to show themselves when there's a wonderful container around you to hold them, to be with them, to support them. And so the polarity of Halloween evening and then All Saints Day the next day, of having those two really close together. If we're living in the polarity of great demonic forces, then it can be very helpful to associate ourselves with times with sacred forces or angelic forces or whatever the opposite is. Not to deny the demons, but so it becomes easier to balance them, to hold them, to be inspired by them. In Mahayana Buddhism, there's these bodhisattvas, which are kind of some very roughly the equivalent of the saints in maybe Catholicism. They have a whole bunch of them, these bodhisattvas, these kind of celestial beings who are enlightened or almost enlightened. And the thing about these bodhisattvas is that most of them are lay people, often with lots of jewels and clothes and all that. And but there's one of the pantheon of bodhisattvas who is a monk. And that monk is a bodhisattva for people who are down and out, people who are really having a horrible time in life, people who have kind of descended into the netherworld, the hells of the human mind. And the idea being that somehow the purity of the monk is the only thing that can speak to people who, to the demons, some of the demons that are deep down, you know, that are so paralyzing and difficult to face. You need to have a counterforce that's as powerful to be able to hold that. So we don't just kind of plunge in by ourselves, but we find somehow to find some place of purity, practice of purity, some kind of pure thing that holds it. Isan Dorsey, who was kind of a friend of mine, he was a Zen priest who was kind of down and out at some point in his life, strung out on drugs, and I don't know if he was living, I don't think he was living in the streets at that point, but he his life was spiraling downwards, out of control. And somewhere on the wall, someone's wall, he saw a photograph of Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian saint. And that somehow got his attention that nothing else had done. It kind of snapped him out of his downward spiral. And he started, somehow found himself to the San Francisco Zen Center and started a spiritual practice. And by the time I met him, he was probably the most inspiring person for me at the San Francisco Zen Center. He was basically illiterate in a culture of people, most of the people were literate, very literate, had been college educated and all that. And and he was just, you know, this being of light and love. And most people, Zen culture back then when I was there, was kind of aloof and a little bit cold. But he had nothing of that. He was just full of love and warmth. So some people come to retreats specifically in order to feel like it's a safe, sacred place to allow these things to surface. Then there's a practice of associating with good friends, which is a very important part for really facing the deepest, darkest places within us. Then there's a practice of vipassana, which is seeing things as they are, which is learning the art, the skill of looking directly in the face of what frightens us the most. Learning to have the skill to not turn away from that which we think is unacceptable. What is that? What is it that's most unacceptable for you? Often what's most unacceptable is that which challenges some of your most cherished ideals and ideas of what it means to be a human being and what it means to live. What is it that's unacceptable? What's unacceptable for the awareness, for your awareness to open up to? And it doesn't mean we condone or accept things out in society and certain behaviors, but in meditation itself, to see things as they are is to somehow open up to give space for what is there without any inhibitions or any resistance or any denials of what's there, and let it be there, and then look it straight in the face. And that can take a lot, sometimes requires a tremendous amount of courage to sit still in this container of meditation and let things bubble up. And just face them, look at them. And Milarepa found his fifth demon to be empty. Maybe all five demons were empty. They were just products of his own mind. And if you're sitting there in meditation, in a safe place, at a safe time, no one's threatening you. There's no threatening activities in the world on you. The dangers that you feel, the great fears that you feel at that point, chances are, in some way or other, they're products of your mind. At that moment, at least. There can't be anything else. Fear about what might happen in the future, ideas you have of what's acceptable and not acceptable. To sit in meditation and look at your deepest fears, to look at that which is unacceptable, and look at it deeply enough, sharp enough, to see its empty nature, to see in the way in which it is a product of your mind. And then seeing how it's a product of your mind, to become free of it. So there are demons, and there are also mentioned what's called hungry ghosts in Buddhism. And hungry ghosts are usually understood as tremendous forces of desire, of addiction. And we're not necessarily afraid of the hungry ghosts. Hungry ghosts are not necessarily afraid. They're not demonic beings. But they're just kind of filled with craving. And the image of the hungry ghost is that they have these very, very, very big bellies and very, very thin little throats. And no matter how much food they can take in, they'll never satisfy their empty belly. So they're always hungry and wanting more and more and more. And there's another image, not less known, for hungry ghosts. And hungry ghosts are these beings who have this great thirst and great hunger. But every time they consume something, take some water or take some food, it turns into fire in their mouth and burns their mouth. So their hunger is never satisfied. They're always wanting more and more, but the very thing they want burns them. So that sometimes we have these hungry ghosts to face. And hungry ghosts sometimes are best faced by loving them, by offering kindness and love. Because probably what the hungry ghost most needs is not food or money or status or, you know, all the things we kind of maybe addicted to. But really deep down inside, it just wants to be loved, to be appreciated. And probably most demons are the same way. That most demons also, deep down inside, within the demon, is something really quite beautiful. And part of the reason to face down the demons is to see that beauty that's within us. So when I taught the children's program here some years ago for Halloween, I made this contraption. We had a different Buddha. But I had this mask over the Buddha like this, and then I had kind of a sheet over everything. And so all you could kind of see was this face, fierce face. And the kids would be kind of far away, and I'd say, okay, I want you need to really look at this demon really carefully. Look inside, look at it deeply and see, what do you see at the heart of the demon inside? And it was this way, what you see inside, you look closely, you see a Buddha. So may all of you find Buddhas inside of your demons and hungry ghosts. May you all make space for it, let them come, and discover wise, healthy ways of being present for them. And may you find healthy ways of avoiding them when they're actually too much to deal with. And may you have tremendous respect for those forces. So those are my thoughts for this evening of Halloween. What are your thoughts? Do you have anything you'd like to say after that?
I have a question. It's when I say anything, but if the demon comes in the form of a tiger, say, how does one cultivate the skill to surrender to that force which totally freaks you, which is totally freaky normally and throws you for a loop. So you have the intention to be with it, you want to be with it, you want to face it, but it's so overwhelming that it like obliterates your intention and you just find...
This is you're talking about in meditation, sitting there.
Yes, I'm talking about in meditation. I'm talking about not just in meditation,
but
on the cushion as well, but really on the cushion you see clearly. I mean, so...
Offer yourself to a tiger. Offer your life. Die. Let yourself die. Sorry?
What's a ghost? What's
a ghost? A ghost in Buddhism is a being which is not satisfied. A disembodied being which is roaming around dissatisfied, looking for some satisfaction. Pulling. So ghosts are not usually understood as being so terrifying exactly, but as, you know, kind of... So on the Sagaki, I mean, they have these ceremonies in Buddhism where they invite, like I read at the beginning, where you invite the ghosts and the demons. You invite these ghosts. And then you feed them. And so once a year, you feed the ghosts to help them along their way. Yes?
You made a comment that, you know, in traditional societies like in Thailand, they believe in ghosts, but actually it's all over the place. Here right in the United States, right in Palo Alto, I found out, I heard someone telling me about the ghost right in the community center down the street from me, which is a known ghost.
Yeah.
So I just felt like...
Yeah, I shouldn't have said...
It's not Thai traditional societies, it's everywhere, it's right here in the Bay Area.
You're completely right.
And there's like a whole network of bed and breakfasts that are famous for ghosts. And they advertise that they're haunted, so that people especially go there for just to experience a ghost. So it's not a traditional society.
Well, we're a traditional society of some sort. But I agree. So I stand corrected. Thank you. I agree. It was in Asia that I discovered that element of society where people have strong beliefs in ghosts. I hadn't really encountered that level in America. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when I lived at Tassajara, there was a job that was given to people to wake up early in the morning and light all the lanterns so that people coming to the Zendo could see where they were going. And during the practice period, this person had to sleep in the Zendo at night. And people were quite terrified to sleep in this beautiful meditation hall, this beautiful Zendo, because there were these rumors that there were ghosts that visited the Zendo at night. And some people were absolutely convinced they could hear footsteps, sort of like the Ajahn Chah story.
I see. I guess the ghosts must have come after my time, because I spent a whole summer sleeping in the Zendo. That's in the particular Zendo. There's a friend of mine who lived up in Skyline, and kind of down a dirt road, off by himself, and in a little cabin. And he started hearing these footsteps at night, and the leaves, you know, and they sounded like, you know, two-footed animal, or, you know, a person, because it's 2 feet, you know, kind of walking. Like 2 feet. I guess you can hear a difference between a four-footed animal. And he'd go out looking, and he was kind of spooked by this, you know. Big, it sounded like a really big, heavy, two-footed person, you know, walking around. And he couldn't find, out in the middle of nowhere. And it happened a number of evenings, a number of nights. And then one day he was driving home down his dirt road and coming close to his house, and he saw what it was. It was an ostrich. Someone up there had an ostrich farm and it escaped.
I don't think there were any ostriches.
And then when I was at Tassajara, it was during a sesshin, during a 7-day intensive retreat. People weren't talking with each other particularly. And the custom was to leave, everybody left their shoes kind of outside of, the door, on the doorstep, kind of outside the door before you go into a cabin or into a place, a house, a building. And most people had slippers they put, because you take them on and off a lot there at Tassajara. And shoes would start disappearing during the sesshin. And often just one shoe would disappear. People come out from, out of the meditation hall and there'd be a shoe missing. Or both their shoes would be missing, and they wake up in the morning and there's more shoes missing. And, and this lasted for, several days. And, people didn't know what to say because they weren't talking to each other. So people weren't, but slowly they came out and, where are the shoes? What's happening with the shoes? And then there was a Dharma talk being given. Dharma talks were at 10 o'clock in the morning. And they had these paper windows that were open, so there's no screen, just open to the outside. And during the Dharma talk, in through one of these windows jumped a baby bobcat. And what had happened was that the SPCA had released a bobcat, up on the Tassajara Road, this 12-mile road, the 14-mile road that goes into Tassajara. And it was kind of in the middle of the Ventana Wilderness, Los Padres National Mountains. And so they thought they would let it off, middle of nowhere. But the mountain lion just followed the road down to the end, and the end of the road is Tassajara Monastery. And it was used to people a little bit. So it was kind of hanging out there and looking for food, and I guess the shoes, were kind of like food for it. And ghosts, demons.
Oh, I have always wondered why, I guess it's the Zen tradition, has a ceremony to honor the dead, where they read the names of the people who have died in previous years. Some ritual, what is that?
Well, usually they do it as part of the Sagaki ceremony. They integrated that into the Sagaki ceremony. Sagaki ceremony is the ceremony where they call forth the demons and the ghosts of the past, and the dead. The dead are sometimes potentially ghosts that are wandering around if they died unsatisfied or something, and so you invite them back. And what's happened in America is that they've adopted the ceremony to also include a kind of memorial time, a kind of memorial ceremony for people who died over the last year. And it's just nice. It's very, very nice. It's very healthy, very helpful for people sometimes to have some place where they do a memorial and kind of recall the people who have died. And, so it's a kind of place to mark that. So
But the original intention was that these ghosts that are wandering around still not settled, give them one more hug.
Yeah, that's my understanding. And I was in Japan, when the monastery there. That's you think about saying traditional society like Thailand. I didn't mean like all of Thailand is traditional. What I meant was traditional culture within Thailand. There's lots of modern Thailand. When you're out in the rural parts of Japan, rural parts of Thailand, but. Rural parts of America, I think, you tend to find much more beliefs in ghosts than you tend to have in the cities. But cities, have ghosts too.
So. The part that I was not happy or, it just jolted me a little bit was the way I heard it was like traditional societies, meaning like superstitious, primitive, less than civilized. That's the way I heard it, even though maybe that's not the way you meant it. And because you also gave some stories about shamanism, which you didn't name as shamanism,
But, you know, when you talked about the guy who blew with the dog, that's really, that's a classic shamanic experience. And also the person turns into the snake that you turn around and became, and you saw a snake. Those are all shamanic experiences that are different than Buddhism and different than demons and ghosts. And I didn't hear you making any distinctions about those differences.
Yeah, I wasn't making any distinctions about it. I just...
But those tend to be considered less than, just in general, they're considered not as, civilized as this culture.
When I was in Burma, in the monastery there, they have this belief in nuts, kind of spirits, tree spirits and stuff. And it was a very big monastery I was living in, a very huge monastery. And strands of Burmese Buddhism is very rational. And one day I was in the abbot's quarters and looked out the window, and there was lay people visiting the monastery who were praying to this big tree in the monastery grounds. And they're praying to these spirits. So I asked the monk what was going on there. What were they doing? Were they praying to the nuts? And it was kind of amazing to watch. He denied that they were doing anything at all. For him, that whole belief in spirits and stuff was, if it had any validity to it, was considered to be secondary or insignificant compared to the importance of Buddhist practice. And he's wanted to kind of... There was no place for it in the monastery, so he just kind of blocked it out of his, at least he's got discussions with me. And you find in Buddhism, in Japan and other places, a kind of a... I'm not saying this is good or bad, but it's kind of... You find a very strong tendency to have a kind of at least a two-tiered attitude towards a lot of things which are very much respected and considered to be have their place in society, but they're considered to be of a lower status than what Buddhist practice can accomplish. So that Indian Buddhism, for example, is very hierarchical, Indian culture in general, very hierarchical in thinking, and things are placed in different hierarchies of what's better than what's better and better and higher status. And so you do find a very strong tendency to put like shamanic experiences at a different level than what Buddhist practice can do in Indian Thai Buddhism. And it isn't just, the modern rationalists who want to do that. But you do find, it's very interesting to find that. So even the notion of gods, if you see the pictures of the Buddha, you never see a picture of a Buddha or a statue of the Buddha with his hands together like this. Even the Buddhists do a lot. It's a beautiful expression to bow like this, but you never see a Buddha doing that, because a Buddha, there's nothing for which the Buddha. The Buddha is the pinnacle, the highest status in the Indian Buddhist kind of situation, and so it would be inappropriate for the Buddha to bow to anything. Even the gods have to bow to the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't bow to the gods. So your issue you raise is a very interesting one and complex. The issue of the status and the tendency to dismiss or not dismiss or put in different hierarchy or different status, different kinds of human experiences and practices, and it's complex and sometimes it's dismissive of other people and other practices, and sometimes it's not. But it's a complex phenomena. And what was interesting for me to go to Asia was to see the degree to which the shamanic experiences and the unseen world of whatever the unseen world is was at times very closely integrated with the Buddhist culture and the Buddhist practices and Buddhist institutions. Whereas here in America, my encounter with Buddhism in America and the unseen world, for the most part, except for this once a year Sagaki ceremony, for the most part, the unseen world and the shamanic experiences were kind of, either were not brought with Buddhism to America, left behind there in Asia. Kind of was very easy to separate it out from and bring it to America, just kind of this simplified or purified, just kind of what some people thought of was just what Buddhism is in and of itself. And how much many of the convert Buddhists in America were simply not interested in that level of what Buddhism, whether it was integrated as part of the Buddhist scene in Asia. But I was surprised how much of it was integrated, even though it was often hierarchical. Anyway, I'm just talking on, and I don't know if it's useful or helpful or if it adds salt to whatever wound that I've caused in my inappropriate remarks. Yes?
I just want to say I went to the Sagaki ceremony at Green Gulch Sunday, and it was a really beautiful ceremony. It began with a cacophony of musical instruments that summoned forth the hungry ghosts. It's quite dramatic and kind of scary. But then the emphasis was very much on satisfying the hungry ghosts within all realms, but also within the individual, the different desires and cravings. And I overheard one resident say to another, "I've really been looking forward to this ceremony. My hungry ghosts are just rampant." It was a really wonderful ceremony.
Okay. So there's about 3 hours left to the evening. So may all of your demons and ghosts and be well attended to. Get their chance. Thank you all very much.